Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the health of your body affect your sense of who you are? And what happens when the great promise of medical breakthroughs fails to deliver much relief or even any answers for the things that go wrong? Siri Hustvedt is best known as a novelist whose critically acclaimed works include The Sorrows of an American and What I Loved. She has spoken in public for years without incident, and so was taken completely by surprise in 2006 when, during an address in honor of her late father, she began to tremble violently from head to toe, so that after the episode, her legs had turned almost purple. Remarkably, she was able to continue speaking throughout the attack and hoped it might have been a one-off anomaly until it happened again and again and again. Hustvedt has spent the past 4 years seeking out professionals who might definitively diagnose her episodes to no avail. She writes about coming to terms with her mysterious affliction in the new book, The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. Siri, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by telling us what you experienced during that first shaking episode?
Well, it was extremely interesting in a way because I remained cognitively very clear. My mind was still working just fine. But really, from the neck down, I was out of control. My limbs were shuddering so violently that I thought I might fall over. And my feeling was, frankly, one of total amazement because I felt a clear separation between my thinking mind and this out-of-control lower body.
And your mother was sitting there in the audience watching all this, and to observe it, she was just terrified for you.
Yes, well, she said it looked like she was watching someone being electrocuted, which is a rather powerful image.
Did it take you a while, Siri, to be alarmed by what was happening to your body?
Yes, you know, I actually had had a seizure once before, and that's in the book, but of a very different kind. It was before a migraine that I had that lasted for a year. I was in an art museum on my honeymoon, and suddenly one of my arms shot up in the air, and I was thrown back against the wall, and then it was over. So I had lived with that knowledge that I had had that single seizure earlier, and this one, I thought, well, could be another strange event, you know, in the history of my nerves, and it might never come back, but then it did, as you said earlier.
And you've had neurological problems, some mild and some relatively severe, throughout your life, including those migraines. You've had them since you were a kid.
Yes, I didn't know they were migraines, but through a neurologist, actually, that I was corresponding with, he really came to the conclusion that I've had migraines and auras since I was very young. And then I had two times in my life of having very, very long migraines that lasted about a year each.
A year. And even now, people who've dealt with this can't imagine, you know, going several days. And even now you wake up with migraine-level pain just about every day.
Often. And I go through periods of being very vulnerable to migraine. I'm not always in excruciating pain, but I have this sense, a kind of cloudy, hypersensitive feeling that I'm vulnerable.
How have you learned to sort of work through pain or even that feeling of vulnerability?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because especially with neurological and psychiatric problems, it becomes rather difficult to separate the illness from the self. And in my case, if you think I've had these migraines since I was very little, my whole life, my whole memory of myself, and accompanied often by some rather strange auras, feelings of transcendence, of being lifted upward, euphoria, and visual disturbances. Once I had a hallucination of a little man and his little ox. They were pink and very lovely, I have to say. All of this has become part of my narrative of myself. And so I think it's often the case that we regard illness as some kind of alien invader. And if you get the measles, that's a perfectly reasonable metaphor because it vanishes after a while. But these chronic, ongoing illnesses, I think, are part of who the person is. And so my philosophy has become to embrace this as not an alien, but part of my very being. And there are good parts of it, too. I mean, the hypersensitivity of migraine is nevertheless something that in other ways can be useful. I think I found my hypersensitivity rather useful as a novelist.
Yeah, you were also hypersensitive to the emotions of other people, so that you sort of can't help taking on how someone else is feeling in the room with you.
Yes, this has always been the case with me. And when I was doing my research for the book, I ran across something called mirror touch synesthesia. This was recently coined in 2005 by some researchers working in England, and they discovered that They found a person who, when she looked at another person being pinched, would have a sensation in her own arm, for example, where the pinch took place in the other person. And they labeled it mirror touch synesthesia. I've always had those sensations, and it was rather amusing to discover that scientists had only recently given it a name.
How long did it take you to realize that not everyone experienced that?
Well, you know, I think as a young child, many children, at least I did, I assumed that my inner reality was very much like the inner reality of other people. When I was eight, I was talking to a friend of mine, and she said to me, "I've never had a headache." And I thought, "She's never had a headache?" I thought everyone had headaches. Well, slowly one begins to realize that, you know, the scope of human experience is very wide, you know, very, very wide. And although we have many, many things in common as human beings, there are nevertheless rather large differences as well.
Was your first thought, I want to go back to the first shaking incident that you had. Mm-hmm. You had spoken at your father's funeral more than 2 years before and been okay.
Fine.
You were sad, but you weren't unable to cope. You felt like your grief was in a good place. Was your first thought, though, that when you gave this address at the university where he had taught for years in a place that was familiar
yes.
to you from your childhood,
yes.
did you assume that this was something psychological?
Well, I instantly had the sense that something is going on here, and it's, you know, related in some way to my father's death. That came to me instantly. It was sometime later, after I'd been puzzling about what this could have been, that I was at a neuroscience lecture in New York, and I remembered an earlier lecture. I was sitting in the same place, and a woman was behind me, and she was a psychiatrist. I asked her about her work, and she said, "I treat mostly conversion patients. Neurologists send them to me, but because they have no idea what to do with them, and that's my work." Well, conversion disorder is the new term for hysteria, the old word hysteria. And hysteria meant not just a screaming woman, which is how we think of it nowadays, but people who developed some kind of apparently neurological disorder, like a paralysis, like a seizure, sometimes muteness, blindness, and they could find no neurological cause for those symptoms. They were labeled hysterics, and they're now called people who have conversion disorder. So I thought to myself, maybe I've had a conversion seizure, and the psychological trigger is my father's death.
Which might have made sense, but then it happened on other occasions when there was no great emotional stake at all.
Exactly. It happened in public, but then it also happened when I was climbing a mountain in the Pyrenees, very happily jumping from stone to stone. I think I hyperventilated, and the hyperventilation triggered a seizure. So that kind of blew my whole hysteria argument to pieces, and also the doctors that I consulted all looked at me and rolled their eyes and said, "No, we really do not think that this is this is hysteria." But I do discuss hysteria in the book because it's very interesting, and it opens up the question of, you know, what is body and what is mind, and how can we really make that distinction?
And you were checked out for things like epilepsy.
Yes. Yes, and I had a brain MRI, and my brain looks completely normal. Now, the truth is that there are people with epilepsy, very severe epilepsy, I might add, who also have completely normal-looking MRIs. And so epilepsy is mysterious. Sometimes you can see it in an MRI, and sometimes you can't.
I want to talk about this. You write about the fact that neurological and mental illnesses are different from other kinds of diseases in that people might say, I'm bipolar, but they don't walk around and say, I am cancerous.
No.
Talk about that.
Well, I think, again, it's that certain kinds of illness seem to be more strongly identified with the self. So that if you have manic depression or bipolar disorder and you are, swiftly cycling from periods of high elation to deep depression, which one is the self? Is it the happy one, the shopper or the, that manic person? Or is it the depressive? Well, it's really both, isn't it? And it's very difficult to separate a mood disorder from the person who has it because this becomes part of the human narrative.
And yet, in our culture, we're encouraged to think of ourselves only as the sort of whole, entirely sane, fully functioning person. We're not encouraged to incorporate what's wrong with us into our sense of identity.
Yes, I think this is true. And it has also to do with something that's quite American, maybe a little more American than European, which is the idea that we're fighters. That something gets in our way, something makes us, less than wonderful or less than perfect, and we sort of declare war on it. Declaring war on chronic illness, I think, is not always a good idea. And in the case of my migraines, it was only when I said to myself, listen, this is chronic. You have this. Now take it into yourself, and let's find out how to live with it. And I have. And the moment I stopped fighting, my relationship to the pain of migraine changed. And I think, everything has meaning in our world. We live in a world of meanings. And how you perceive your own illness is extremely important to how you live with it.
Well, it struck me reading your book that it's very different from most others I've read in the genre, if you can call it that, because this is not, strictly speaking, a story of you triumphing over
no.
the problems in your body. In fact, you end up without much of a resolution in terms of what your problem is.
That's right. And I think what you used a word that I have often used myself, which is triumphant. And we do have a narrative in present-day culture in the United States, and I think elsewhere too, that, that what people want is this, the fight, the war, and then the triumphant ending. And, of course, we understand why people want this because it makes good sense. I mean, it's very liberating. But the truth is that much of life is not like that. Much of life is something quite different. It's accommodation. It's thinking through a problem that finally won't go away.
My guest this hour is novelist and memoirist Siri Hustvedt. Her newest book is called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and memoirist Siri Hustvedt. Her latest book is called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. Siri, we were talking before the break about the fact that many of us seem to long for the story with the triumphant ending, and certainly medical professionals are not immune to this. You tell a story here about the time during which you were hospitalized during that year-long migraine, and one of your doctors was sort of visibly annoyed at your body's refusal to heal based on the treatments that you were receiving.
Yes, I think I was a frustrating patient, and I can tell you I really wanted to please my doctor and get well, but I simply didn't. I was hospitalized I was supposed to be hospitalized for 10 days, but I checked myself out after 8 because there really was no change. I was in terrible pain, and I'd been given a very powerful antipsychotic drug called Thorazine. So I was lying there in a stupor, but I still had the headache, and it really didn't help me. After that, I was sent to someone who taught me how to do biofeedback, which is essentially a kind of machine-monitored deep meditation. And that really did help relieve the worst of my pain, and I continue to use not the machine, but deep relaxation techniques to help with the migraine pain.
Did you struggle with the assumption that you might be mentally ill?
Well, I don't think I've actually ever been sort of mentally ill, but when I was very young, I remember it. I think the only time I had a fear of that was that when I was about 11, 12, I had a period where I heard voices. Now, I understand as an adult that hearing voices, especially brief auditory hallucinations, is quite common. There's a significant part of the population that does have them. And I was just rereading Nabokov's Speak Memory. He often had auditory hallucinations before he went to sleep. And, you know, it's not a sign of madness. But when I was 11, I didn't tell anyone because it did frighten me. And what frightened me was I thought maybe I was going crazy. I have taught psychiatric patients in the hospital. I've been a volunteer writing teacher at Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic in New York City. And there are indeed a lot of people who in manic states are tormented by voices, and people with schizophrenia who are constantly hounded by voices. The difference is that usually with mentally ill patients, they are deluded into thinking that the voices are, say, you know, classically coming from a computer chip in their brain or something like that. There's a delusion that accompanies the hallucination. Normal people generally just think, oh, gosh, I'm hearing voices.
And remarkably, once you finally did talk about this with members of your family, you found out that even within your own family, you weren't alone.
Absolutely. My father, I remember, very calmly told me that after his father died, his own father, my grandfather, he would hear his father calling him from time to time. And two of my three sisters have also had short periods of hearing voices. The only time I hear voices now, it's very much like Nabokov, it's before I'm going off to sleep. Mm-hmm. And I also have hypnagogic hallucinations, which is those pictures that many people see before they drop into sleep.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Siri Hustvedt, whose newest book is called The Shaking Woman or A History of My Nerves. Let's go on the phone to Anne in Murphy. Hi, Anne.
Hi, good afternoon. I enjoy listening to your show, and I thought I would call you up on a question of medical information. You mentioned that you had had an MRI brain scan, and I myself have had several due to chronic pain issues that they've never been able to find.
Oh.
However, my brother-in-law, who was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's, had both a brain MRI as well as something called a SPECT scan.
Yes, I
have
I know about the SPECT scan.
Okay. Well, the brain MRI showed absolutely nothing. The SPECT scan showed up with many lesions, and the neurologist could not reconcile the difference between the two. But I was wondering if you'd had one and your comments on it, and I'll take my information off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. I have not had a SPECT scan. I mean, you know, this neurological story is ongoing, and, you know, I do see a neurologist, so we'll see what happens. I might end up with a SPECT scan. I'm not sure. But there's no question that these new devices of brain scans, there are several different kinds. I think SPECT might be one that is more invasive than an MRI. I can't remember. But so perhaps it's a second go-around, not the first thing that doctors do. But, you know, the question about lesions or not lesions is very old in neurology. And sometimes they are able to see it physically, and sometimes they aren't. The brain scans have made it easier, but it doesn't necessarily solve the problem of a diagnosis.
Now, you still don't know exactly what's going on, but you have found at least some drug therapy that can help you. Is that right?
Yes, yes. I think that probably the seizures are triggered by some release of stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, that kind of thing, so that that may be what is setting me off. And I take beta blockers to, you know, lower my blood pressure and keep myself from going into seizing orbit.
When you were first looking for help with this, Siri, did the doctors, some of whom sort of expressed a lack of belief in what you were talking about or a lack of real concern, did they cause you to question your own perspective on what was happening to your body?
Well, I have to tell you that really what this book is a person, myself, taking my own symptom and examining it through the lenses of many different disciplines. Psychoanalysis, psychiatry, neurology, neuroscience research, and seeing what I come up with. So I get to be, in some funny way, doctor and patient mm-hmm. at the same time. And by the time I saw doctors for this particular disorder, I think they were, you know, they were good, actually. They were interesting. They understood that I was deeply informed about the subject. And so... I didn't feel poo-pooed. You know, I did, I have to say, when I was much younger and I was making the rounds of neurologists for migraine. And, you know, migraine has sort of gained in medical status since I was very ill for those two long periods. And I think it has to do with new research that's showing changes in the brain when a migraine is taking place.
What does it take for medical professionals to look at a patient as a whole person as opposed to a collection of symptoms?
Well, this is a deep and, I think, vital question. Just last week, I did an event with a doctor at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. She runs something called the Narrative Medicine department there, and her wish is to bring storytelling and the idea of the whole human being back to medicine. Her name is Rita Sharon, and I think this is vital, because isolating illness, abstracting illness from person, is usually not a terribly good idea, because the way the illness presents itself is very deeply, I think, related to the human story.
Do you think of yourself as a sick person?
No, I don't really. I do not have invalid consciousness, if you will. Mm-hmm. I have a sense that because of migraine, because of this shaking now, that I have certain greater restraints that I wouldn't have if I weren't plagued by these bothersome illnesses. But I don't live inside myself at all as a victim of these illnesses or as, you know, a truly sick person.
I want to go back for a minute to talk about this idea of reintroducing narrative. And you've been sort of frustrated to look at the DSM and the fact that there
Yes.
are no stories in the DSM.
Right. Well, the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, was created to, you know, bring all the wings of psychology and psychiatry together and say this is what this particular illness looks like. And they did not want to deal with causes, and they did not want to deal with the stories. There is a casebook of separate stories for the DSM, you know, with little stories about patients, but it's not part of it. And this essentially DSM lists symptoms, you know, and if you have those symptoms, then you can be categorized as someone with that illness. My feeling is that, as you know, I think this is full of goodwill, but it's the wrong approach. Say, especially with psychiatric illnesses, they grow and they come about through the story of a person.
So for you, as both patient and sufferer and objective observer and chronicler of the entire field, what changes when you read stories as opposed to reading simply collections of symptoms and trying to sort of attach them to a nameless person?
You know, I have to tell you, if I didn't think that the way an illness develops, especially in psychiatry, is important to the diagnosis, I would say, fine, you know, go for it, DSM. But the fact is that, you know, illnesses appear in, say, young people, say someone who's suffering from schizophrenia. It makes its appearance. It's obviously related to brain changes, but it's also related to the external world, to the life of that person, to loved ones. You cannot just separate an illness from this huge and very important context that also takes place in time.
Talk for a minute about some of the work that you've done with people who are suffering from some of these illnesses to try and help them, maybe the word is cope, with what they're dealing with?
Yes, it's interesting. When I first started as a volunteer at Payne Whitney, I wasn't at all sure that a writing workshop was going to be more than a distraction for these people, that it could actually have some therapeutic value. I really didn't know. As I went on, however, I discovered that most of the time, the people in my classes left feeling better than when they came in. Now, I cannot say how long that lasted, but I did begin to understand that writing, especially for people who are in disarray, who are feeling very fragmented, that writing can fix something about yourself on the page in a kind of stillness. And also, you can put down certain inner complex feelings onto the page, and this really did seem to be a good idea.
And you tell a story here, it's been documented in the past, that people who are unable to communicate verbally sometimes really can't express their thoughts, can write it. Can you talk about that?
Oh, this is one of the strangest stories. I will start with this story that I ran across in Brain, which is, a professional place where they have, you know, science papers. This boy, he was 13 years old, I believe. They gave him the name Neil in the paper. Had suffered from a brain tumor, and he had to. He was treated for the tumor, which shrank, and he lived. But he also lost all his memory from after the treatment. In other words, he could not lay down any new memories. So that when he was in school, they would ask him a question, the teacher would ask him a question, and by the time he was starting to answer, he couldn't remember what she had asked. They discovered something fascinating, which was the only way Neil could remember was when he wrote. So that if his mother asked him, what did you do in school, he could pick up a pencil, write the events, but he would not know what he had written. But she could read it and find out. So really, he had a kind of motor memory in his hand that was nowhere else.
And you sort of observe that motor memory even in your own work. You feel like writing, for you, can yield different kinds of memories than speaking.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this this goes back to a much earlier concept in the 19th century of automatic writing, where some patients, especially patients with hysteria, were, you know, given a pen and they would just write, and memories would emerge in the writing that they were unable to talk about. And this was used as a form of treatment. I think that many writers, you know, when you're in a groove, when you're writing well, the work seems to write itself. And this is a strange phenomenon because you really aren't aware of where the words are coming from. And there, you know, writers, many writers have commented on this. For me, it's certainly not all the case all the time. I grind out passages as well. But then every once in a while, it comes as a gift. And you have no idea where this is coming from.
Do you ever feel like maybe you're self-medicating through writing?
Well, again, I did discover, I've always thought, you know, if you write, sometimes you have a tremendous need, say, to write a novel, and it has to be about the subject that you've chosen. It has to be this. But it doesn't really solve life's problems. But there's no question that the energy given and the mastery needed does have, I think, a therapeutic benefit.
My guest this hour is novelist and memoirist Siri Hustvedt. Her newest book is called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us now. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and memoirist Siri Hustvedt. Her new book is called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Don in Dallas, who writes, Dr. John Sarno of the NYU School of Medicine has proposed that repressed emotional pain in the unconscious mind is often the source of difficult to explain and difficult to treat musculoskeletal pain. In essence, the mind uses physical pain to distract from emotional pain. Are you familiar with the theory, and what are your thoughts?
Yes, I am deeply familiar with this theory, and I can tell you it's not a new one, because essentially what the doctor at NYU is arguing is what 19th century physicians Pierre Janet was arguing, you know, over 100 years ago, which was simply this, that emotional conflicts create conversion experiences, that the origin of that, it is what, you know, the psyche is not able to digest, so it is transformed into a physical ailment. So it's a very, very old theory, and I know for a fact that it's also been reborn, that there are researchers who are going back to someone like Janet. And, of course, later, after Janet, or about the same time, Freud, who was influenced by these French doctors, was arguing something very similar. So this is not a new theory at all. It's a very old one.
You know, Siri, it's interesting because it seems that people, either find that these theories make perfect sense or they feel like they must be nonsense. Why do you think there's such a black and white divide between people's willingness to sort of accept the possibility of this?
Well, I think this has something to do with the very uneasy divide between the psychological and the physiological. I mean, now, for example, they found out that in conversion patients, there are asymmetries in their brains, and if the disorder, say a paralysis, goes away, the asymmetries clear up. So that shows that there's something organic happening as well as psychological because, you know, hate, fear, love, all of these emotions are, you know, undergirded by these neural circuits in the brain. They're also physiological. And take something very simple, like the placebo effect. Everybody knows that it's true. Everybody knows that it works. Well, researchers have now discovered that when you take a pill and you think it's going to make you feel better, you do feel better. And one of the reasons is because apparently this thought, the cognitive factor, just thinking, the idea, you know, it doesn't have to be conscious even, but that idea releases endogenous opioids in the brain that make you feel better. So here is a completely outside, you know, we think of as a psychological factor having a very important effect on the body. So I think often it's a problem with people thinking this material through. Also, Freud has had such, you know, a terrible reputation, and I often am, you know, at a dinner party, and Freud is mentioned, and everybody, you know, rolls their eyes, and I always think, well, you know, actually, there are a lot of things that Freud said that are absolutely true, and one is that most of what happens in our mind brain is unconscious, you know, and we have implicit memories, memories that we do not have consciously. So these are, you know, very old ideas that Freud was talking about, not just Freud, but other scientists working during the time when Freud was writing and before.
You write in the book about the fact that your husband has said that maybe you're obsessively reading all this research. Did you worry at any point that you were sort of perpetuating this? Well, that you were perpetuating this by really focusing on it, or do you feel like this is the best way you have to sort of heal?
No, actually, that's an interesting question, but I think, no, there's no question that I'm an obsessive reader, that I can't get enough, that my curiosity is voracious. That's for sure. But I do not think I perpetuated it at all. In fact, what came out of writing the book for me, I think, was rather than, you know, a sense of, oh, my God, I'm just thinking about my symptoms all the time, it really wasn't the case because I went moving through so many different disciplines and into medical history. And what I felt was a sense of mastery. Not that I could cure my illness, but that I sure as heck could think about it very well. And you know, actually doctors and psychiatrists and brain researchers who have read the book have really loved it and responded to it very warmly. So this has given me a good feeling. As I say, I'm not cured, but the act of writing and was very good for me.
Is there a disconnect at all between wanting to be better and also needing and wanting to accept this as part of who you are for at least the present time?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm not going to refuse treatment or anything like that. I'm not saying this is it. And, you know, because, again, you know, illnesses can develop and change. And so I really don't know what lies ahead for me. But I do know that a kind of calm resignation and, you know, lack of panic is a physiologically good thing as well as a psychologically good thing, because when the body is relaxed in a mode of acceptance or resignation, it is, you know, it's at a lower, in a lower key, and that lower key is actually helpful for pain, you know, and for all kinds of disturbances.
Siri Hustvedt is my guest. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. We'll go next on the phones to Ida Lee in Dallas. Hi, Ida Lee.
Well, I wanted to kind of comment on what was being said about the DSM.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, I'm a student at the University of Dallas. I'm a graduate psychology student, and I'm
right.
in an assessment course, and we are actually using the PDM, the Psychodynamic Diagnostic Manual, and so I just wanted to know if you'd ever heard of it. But basically, we talk about the whole person, how mental illness is on a continuum. It is not categorizing the individual, and the whole philosophy of this psychology program is actually looking at the whole person. We do a lot of psychoanalysis teaching, talk about Freud, and so it's just very nice to hear somebody from the public discussing it this way, and just wanted to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, that's great, and I think you're on the right track, and I have heard about it, but I have never studied it. There are some alternative, diagnostic manuals, and there's a woman named Nancy Williams, who's a psychoanalyst who has done something that's really very interesting. And so I have to tell you, too, that it's heartening to hear this about a psychology, department, graduate psychology department, because I do think that any number of people in these related fields are starting to feel a tug to include narrative, to include different disciplines. So, for example, you're just not doing behaviorist psychology, but you're talking about psychoanalysis, you're talking about neurobiology, and bringing these fields together and bringing all these different categories together, I think, is much more enriching than sticking in a kind of, very rigid grid.
Talking about this idea of your sense of who you are, I think it's very interesting that you refer sort of in the third person to the shaking woman.
Uh-huh.
Do you always feel like she is you?
No, I mean, I think that, and I think the narrative of the book to some degree is emotion from feeling that the shaking woman is this, completely out of control, sort of character out of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And then saying, no, actually, this is part of the story, and it has to be integrated into my notion of myself. So that is really part of the journey of the book. As I said earlier, the first time I shook, I was just amazed and appalled. I couldn't believe, that my body had just kind of left me behind. That's how I felt. So I think integration for me is part of the drama of the book.
What sort of element is fear that this will happen again in your everyday life?
Well, I think that, when this really started happening and before I had the medicine, I really did have, I was so afraid that it would come over me, if I got up to talk or read or do whatever, that suddenly I would be constantly having these shuddering fits in public. Now, I have to say that I've also said to myself, since I got through all those shuddering fits, that, the worst thing so far that can happen is that I shudder in public. And to be frank, there are many worse things in life than that.
I'm really impressed, though, that you got back on the horse, as it were. A lot of people who have had similar incidents or perhaps panic attacks or for whatever reason suddenly find themselves unable to perform in public just retreat from that.
Yes, I've actually a number of people have talked to me or come up to me at various events and said that something similar had happened and they just stopped. But the truth is, I don't want to stop. And so if I can accommodate this thing into not stopping, I really want to keep going because I enjoy speaking in public and I enjoy reading and I enjoy giving lectures. So I'm saying yes, and we'll just see how it goes.
And I guess that sort of facing, what could happen is now also part of who you are.
Yes, I think it is. And also knowing that, to be honest, the times when I've had these violent fits in public, people have been actually very kind. I haven't found that, you know, people throw apples at me or anything like that.
You talked earlier, Siri, about what you have gained from trying to create this narrative of your experiences. Have you lost anything in the same process?
I don't really think so. I don't know what I could have lost. You know, there's a book there where there wasn't one before, a book that I took great pleasure in writing. You know, we are not... You know, our lives keep changing, and in some way, who we are continues to change, too. We're always in flux. And so that book stands as a record and an investigation of a moment in my life.
How different is it when you have customarily been writing fiction, at least in your book-length works, to switch over into nonfiction?
Well, this is my first book, long book, but I write a lot of essays, and I actually write about art. I've written about literature. I am giving a lecture about neuroscience, art, and psychoanalysis in Baltimore in the fall, and I'm giving the annual Sigmund Freud lecture in Vienna in 2011. Mm-hmm. So I am thinking, you know, I have a whole sort of intellectual life aside from my fiction writing, which is also part of my intellectual life. So I don't make a huge divide between them.
And was it difficult at all to say, I'm going to write something about my personal life?
Well, I think, you know, the way the book works is that, as I'm sort of both detective and victim.
Right, right.
And so that side of it, you know, there's a very personal side, and a highly impersonal side as well. So the dialectic, if you will, between that kind of third-person objective, let's see what this is, and the subjective personal, you know, this moving back and forth between the two positions, I think, at least as a writer, you know, it didn't give me that, like, queasy confessional quality.
And it doesn't read that, it doesn't read that, like, way either, so for people who haven't yet picked up a copy. Not at all. But it is, you're still sort of giving something up that otherwise you might have kept for yourself.
That's true. And maybe that's one of the strange things about writers, is that, you know, we get this need or push to do something, and then the project takes over. In other words, it felt to me that it had to be done that way, and that's how it came out.
Siri Husted's novels include The Sorrows of an American and What I Loved. Her new memoir is called The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. Siri, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with
us. I've had a great time talking to you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.